liberated carbon, it'll spin your wheels. Liberated carbon, it'll nuke your meals. Liberated carbon, it'll turn your night to day. Come on and liberate some carbon, babe, it's the American way.
Welcome to Eco Talk, where we green the red and blue states one show at a time. We have another jam-packed hour for you. In our first half, we'll talk to two environment reporters about the Montreal Climate Change Conference, which wrapped up in Montreal last weekend. In our third segment, we'll learn about the devastating drought underway in the Brazilian rainforest, another likely manifestation of climate disruption. And in our last segment, we'll be speaking with the new president of the Apollo Alliance about the Energy Department's forecast for oil and other fossil fuels. And our theme song today, want to mention, is appropriate to our topic. It's called Liberated Carbon, and it is the great work of our first guest, Andy Revkin. He is a science reporter with the New York Times. But before we go to Andy, I just want to thank our sponsor, the Natural Resources Defense Council, the nation's leading environmental action organization, the NRDC, using law, science, and the support of more than 1.2 million members and online activists to protect the planet's wildlife and wild places, and to ensure a safe, healthy environment for all living things, and also to keep EcoTalk sustainable. For all that and more, we thank the NRDC. Now we're going to welcome Andy Revkin, and he's had a busy couple of weeks covering that climate change conference in Montreal, and I've been reading his dispatches with great interest, and thanks for joining us, Andy.
It's my pleasure to be here. A little noisy here in New York City, but here I am.
Always. Okay, so speak loud and tell us what happened and what did not take place during this meeting.
Well, it was a very marginal kind of advance, depending on who you talk to. These talks have been going on for a long time, since 1989, really since 88, if you start the first science conference. And that means we really haven't come that far in terms of finding some way to get an international consensus on what to do. Developing countries don't want to move until the industrialized, wealthy nations of the world do something about their emissions. And the biggest industrialized nation, the United States, doesn't want to move until it sees some sign that the developing countries like China and India are going to sign on. So that leaves everyone in a very sticky place.
And who was there to represent the U.S. and China and India?
Well, every nation sends a delegation of essentially the equivalent of State Department, or people here from the State Department. And they all represent their governments, and they're always on the phone consulting back with the main office. In this case, being the White House. And the delegates for the United States made it very clear that they were given orders straight from the start to not negotiate on anything. Harlan Watson, the lead negotiator for the United States, said that straight out to me. That's their marching orders, and people in the State Department do what they're told.
And was there any movement at all on our part?
No, we agreed to... We agreed to continue talking about these things in some coming meetings, but only with this huge kind of proviso, which was they were totally non-binding talks, and they would never lead to negotiations on anything binding. So that's kind of like me saying to you, I'm thinking about giving you my house, but I'm not going to commit to it.
Do you think
it doesn't really say anything.
Right, especially, I mean, this conference comes, you would think, at a really compelling time in the wake of this devastating season of hurricanes, killer tornadoes, twisters, and all kinds of things, including what we're going to be talking about later in this hour, which is extreme drought conditions now in Brazil. Was there a general consensus that global warming is real and it has arrived?
Well, yeah, there is. In fact, you just go back to even President Bush in July on his way to the Group of Eight meeting in Scotland, said straight out, for the first time, that he believed personally that humans were contributing to warming by increasing greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and that this constitutes a problem, quote unquote. He had never used that word. He'd always called it an issue, which can mean a lot of things. So the science is really not where the issues are. It's more on these questions of equity and trends, and who has the responsibility to go first. And in the history of environmental treaty making, the industrialized powers always have gone first. That was true for the Montreal Protocol on the ozone layer, and many people insist that should be true here, too.
Now, the U.S. position has been that they cannot sign on to Kyoto Protocol because it would be bad for the economy, would take a lot of jobs, and you only have to look at, you know, the devastation, job loss, life loss during this, you know, hurricane season to say, well, gee, maybe that's not the case. And they also say that we want to, you know, rely on new technology, much of it yet to be invented, and also on voluntary measures. What was the consensus about that? Why might that not be enough?
Well, all the scientists I've been talking to on this for many years now say that you do need a fundamental advance in technology to kind of avoid a big pulse of greenhouse gas buildup in a couple of decades. The problem that many critics of the administration have is that they say that, well, they talk the game of having a big technological push. We really haven't done anything meaningful. Most of the research and development money the administration has out there is in the form of subsidies or soft grants, and there isn't enough out there to really do things like find a way to make solar to take it through that real revolutionary step that we need to go through to become a big part of the energy scheme, that kind of thing. Technology is essential. It's an essential part of whatever happens between now and 2050 to avoid a really big change in the climate. But it's also widely perceived by many experts in this field to not be enough in itself, too. You also need to start now with whatever emissions gains you can get from efficiency and things like that as well.
So United States not budging obviously was a disappointment, perhaps not a surprise. Were there any positive outcomes?
Well, one was that Europe and the other countries that have signed on to the binding treaty to cut greenhouse gas emissions, they agreed to negotiate a new set of targets and timetables once the 2012 limits of the existing Kyoto Treaty expire. Now, they also kind of softened their commitment. They didn't say, we're going to do this by X date. So they've kind of stayed a little open-ended and soft on that front, too, which I would count as problematic. I did a piece for the Times that's still up on the web at nytimes.com/earth that lays out pretty clearly that the whole idea of the Kyoto Protocol was that it was a first modest step toward much basically deeper, broader cuts in these emissions and every step in new treaties down the line. And it doesn't look very likely that like that's going to happen either.
Yeah, one of your articles was pretty, sort of left me depressed, actually, talking about how, you know, even if all went well, and it didn't, of course, with the U.S. intransigence, but it's not enough. And was there that sense at the end of it that, I mean, on the one hand, we've got the U.S. saying we can take care of this through voluntary measures and technology. Then there's also many people and countries and mayors that feel, you know, this is an urgent thing here. This isn't even enough. Kyoto is only the beginning. Was there any reconciliation of those two views at all?
Well,
can there be?
You know, it was a little depressing, that story, and I've been covering this since the very first meeting called the Meeting on the Changing Atmosphere in 1988, and the slow acceptance of the human species that we are influencing climate is at a pace that it's like our learning curve is not quite matched our impact curve,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not quite sure it'll catch up. Some of this has to do with just the nature of humans. We tend to discount longer-term costs in favor of short-term ones. And I explored this issue a little bit this summer in another story on this concept called gross national happiness, which is how do you measure progress, how do you kind of weigh your impacts and costs that take into account in ways that take into account longer-term goals. And in the 21st century of an ever more crowded world with an ever greater energy thirst, you really do wonder whether we'll catch on soon to the idea that we need to do some things now in a pretty ambitious way to avoid bigger problems down the line.
Well, given the current administration's position, we're not going to do it, given we're the biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, some 25% of the carbon dioxide in the world. And if we acted today, it still wouldn't be enough. It is kind of frightening to think about the prospects for waking up in time.
It does get a little circular, though. I did a piece in 2001 when the administration was just forming its energy policy and everything, and I quoted an economic advisor to the White House who had been in a meeting there who said, essentially for them, this isn't going to become a significant issue until it's a domestic political issue. In other words, something that will get someone elected or unelected. And this sort of puts the ball back in the court of the public. People, frankly, aren't agitated about this. It's easy to sort of blame the person at the head of the line, mm-hmm. the president, but mm-hmm. Americans still tend to put these other things ahead of this. There isn't a lot of leadership. No one has seen the political value in making this a number one issue because, frankly, it doesn't rise to that level among the public. And that kind of comes from everything from the lack of adequate science education to all kinds of broader issues about how we deal with long-term problems in this country.
Which is why the media is so important, and for the most part, the mainstream media has been missing in action, other than the New York Times and your stories, I must say. We only have about 30 seconds left. Tell us about Liberated Carbon. What motivated you to do this song?
Well, I've been a musician for a long time, and frankly, I don't think I could do my day job if I didn't also have music to fall back on. And I'm in a band called Uncle Wade. We do what we call simple music for complicated times. Rustic, rootsy stuff, and I just write about what I see. And frankly, I don't do a lot of themes. I'm not like a protest singer or anything like that. But I've been grappling with this whole fossil era for a while, and I just thought it was fun to play around with.
Thanks, Andy. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Andy Revkin with the New York Times, and also the singer of this song.